Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 5, delivered on January 29, 2013. The title of this lecture is Monetary Policy.
Today, monetary policy. I'll begin this lecture with a minor example to show why businesses care about interest rates. You have a business and you have three proposed projects that are in front of you for the coming year. Projects and rate of return, we'll use that term for this. Now, the project A has a rate of return of 18%. Project B has a rate of return of 12%, and Project C has a rate of return of 6%. Oh, can you see it now? There. Okay. Now, suppose that you can acquire capital, borrow it or otherwise, acquire capital at a marginal cost of, let's say, 4%. I can get money at 4% if I want to finance these projects. Now talk to me, would you take on project A yielding 18% if you can borrow the money to do it at 4%?
Depends how long.
Don't make it complicated.
Oh, then yeah.
Yes, okay. You're thinking too far ahead. We're not philosophers, unless we get drunk, okay? Sure, I mean, 4% money to get 18%, any day of the week I'll do that. Project B, well, heck, 12%. It's not as great as Project A, but of course I will. If I can get money at 4% and turn it around for 12%, absolutely. Project C, same thing, 6%. It kind of sucks as a project, but who cares? I can get money at 4%. And I can turn it over for 6%, of course I'll do projects. See, I'll do all these projects. Okay, suppose that the interest rate environment rises, and now it costs 8% to get money. I'll still take project A. Oh, yeah. Because I borrow 8%, turn it into 18%, sure. Project B, absolutely. 12% I can get on 8% money, absolutely. But Project C, well, that can bite me. Because it cost me 8% to get 6% money? No. So at 8%, I lose one of my projects. And I lose the jobs that I would have created for that project. I lose the profit in the corporation that I could have garnered from originally. Now suppose that interest rates rise to 14%. Well, C is definitely out, and B is also out because that returned 12%, and it cost me 14% to get the money. No, I'm done. Game over. So you see, as interest rates rise, business investment is suppressed. No question about it. There's another thing that's going on too, and I'll get to that in just a minute here. But the first consequence is a rising interest rate environment slows down business investment. And as a consequence, the jobs that I would have created from having these projects running, those are gone. The money I would have made off those projects, that's gone. The products themselves that would have come out of those projects, those are gone. Goods or services, gone. Rising interest rates hurt investment, hurt the economy. But there's another thing going on, too. This is a little bit more complicated, but it's a very important point. Look, You see these project 18%, 12%, 6%. Compared to project A, well, is there anything you could say about project C, knowing that project A returned 18%, C returned only 6%? Is there anything that you could tell me about probably what was going on with project C relative to project A? What's the relationship between risk and expected return? Project A is higher expected return, so it's higher. Good. Project C is a lower risk project than project A. So if you look here, when those interest rates were going up, they were systematically clipping off the lower expected return, lower risk projects. So as the interest rate environment rose, that means that the overall portfolio risk of projects of the company was going up, to the point where by the time you get to 14%, this company is doing nothing but Hail Marys, because that's all it's got left that it could possibly make money off from are high-risk projects. In other words, the long bomb kinds of projects. The company becomes riskier. Its prospects of survival become less, not just because its profits are going down because it doesn't have as many projects running, but also because the company's risk on the project that it still has is higher, which is adding to the default probability in an economy where interest rates are rising. Part of it's just because the economy sucks. Not as many jobs, not as many people buying products, that whole thing. But also because the companies are being flogged, as the interest rates go up, they're being flogged to try riskier and riskier things. There was a time earlier in your life, madam, when you were making big money. You were at the top of the world. And you ate well every night. Now you're down to your last dollar. It's all or nothing tonight, because if it doesn't work tonight, well, I don't want to talk about how grim it is. And I come up to you, hey lady, I got a lottery ticket. A dollar could win you $20,000. Now, when you were on top of the world, I come up to you like that, hey lady, I got a lottery ticket. You know, you'd pull out your mace and, you know, take care of the problem. But now, your last dollar, it's a dark alley. You're alone. The YMCA is closed. Do you see how you would be more likely to take this ridiculous risk on your last dollar? That's what happens in a bad economy, as you will see the long bomb. The people who have very little left, so there is less to lose. That's why you'll see poor people buy lottery tickets. It's a game. Everyone knows what we're doing. People who have less are more willing to throw the long bomb to get something. When you're on top of the world, why would you throw the long bomb? You don't need to take that kind of risk. But that's the same way it is with companies. Is that when they are pushed back to the wall, all they've got left is the possibility of the win on something highly risky. Because that's basically, there's nothing left for them to do. That's the context in which I take you into monetary policy. How we can speed up the economy with monetary policy, and how we can slow it down. How we can actually bring, if we don't do it well, we can actually accidentally, or maybe intentionally, drive an economy into recession simply by bringing up interest rates. Businesses stop investing, and then so lo and behold, the economy is slowing down. But here we go. The Federal Reserve. Remember I told you that the Federal Reserve has three jobs. One of them is that it is a regulator and supervisor, regulates and supervises the banks. And again, I advise you to know that this doesn't mean all banks, because there's a whole lot of turf involved there. Thing two that the Federal Reserve does is it is a bank for banks. So the banks, when they need a bank for their banking services, they can go to the Federal Reserve, but they don't have to because the Fed competes directly with other private banks, bank for banks. And then the big third one. Ah, that hurt like hell. God, an acetate cut. No, I'm serious, noobs. That hurt. You ever wonder when you get a paper cut if that's the tree's last revenge against you for killing it? I don't know. Just thinking about never mind. Okay. And then the third thing the Federal Reserve does is it conducts monetary policy. It conducts monetary policy. And it does this three different ways. Do you see, am I tripping or is that? Right, look at that. My first reaction is, dude. Really? There. Oh, the 60s were good. They keep coming. And monetary policy. There are three different tools that it has. And this is review from the last lecture, just to get up to speed here. And if I get my momentum going, you actually, this, oh well, anyway, yeah. Okay. The first tool is a blunt tool. It's the required reserve ratio that I talked about. How much of deposits, demand deposits, a bank must keep in the vault to satisfy demands on those deposits, the required reserve ratio. You raise it, and banks don't have as much money to lend out to multiply the money supply. You lower it, and banks have more money that is deposited that they can lend out. This is a blunt tool. It is a blunt tool. And it's not really used for monetary policy so much as it is just, it's raised a little bit if there's worry about the economy, it's lowered if there is more confidence in the economy. The second one, and I want to get into this a little bit more, the discount rate. Now banks, when they need money, just because they want to lend money or because they want to meet the required reserve ratio for the night or something like that, they can go to the Federal Reserve and borrow money from the Fed at what is called the discount window. And the Fed sets the rate at the discount window. Or banks can go out into the banking community itself, into this vast ocean called the Federal Reserve pool of money. It's all the bank's money in this giant pool, electronic pool as it is, and they could borrow money from that pool. Now, if they borrow money from that pool, they will pay a higher interest rate because that interest rate is just shaped by the supply of and demand for money in the pool. So if there's tons of money in the pool, the federal funds rate is low. If there is little money in the pool, the federal funds rate is high. So that is a market-driven rate. So banks can go and get this discount rate from the Fed's discount window, borrow from the Fed. Or they can go out and get the federal funds rate, borrow at the federal funds rate from this vast pool of interbank lending funds. That's also the pool from which banks lend you guys money or businesses money too. The Fed sets the discount rate. It does not set the federal funds rate. It manipulates it to the extent that it can by trying to suck money out of that vast pool or push money into that vast pool. That's our third place we're going to talk about. But you will see so many times in finance, if you get into reading or reading financial literature or watching the financial pages, you'll see that the Federal Reserve has meetings, and at these meetings, it sets the discount rate until the next meeting. But then you'll hear them say that the Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate. It does not. It will set a target for what it wants it to be, but it cannot set a market rate. It's a private market, basically, and the Fed can play in that market and move the rate around by what are called open market operations, but it can't set the rate. Watch it. I will try to trick you on the exam, on the first exam. The Federal Reserve sets the federal funds rate, right? Yeah, yeah. No, it doesn't. It can manipulate it. It can set a target, but it cannot set it. It can set the discount rate. Like I said, the federal funds rate is higher than the discount rate. Now, historically, banks didn't go to the discount window. They went to the federal funds market, even though the rate was higher there. And as we talked about last time, it's obvious that if you have a choice between going to the man himself and saying, hey, I need some money, or going to your friends and borrowing at a higher rate, you'll probably go to your friends because you don't need the aggravation from the Fed. Interestingly enough, though, now the Fed, even though banks historically didn't use this rate, this was a much watched rate because it was sort of like a signal the Fed was sending. If the Federal Reserve raised the discount rate, that told investors, well, the Fed wants interest rates in the economy to go up. And this was sort of like its way of signaling that that's what it wanted. If the Federal Reserve lowered the discount rate, the Federal Reserve was saying, well, we're kind of worried about the economy. We want to bring all interest rates down, and this is our way of signaling this is what we want to happen. And so we'd see the Federal Reserve notch the discount rate down, maybe 0.25%. That'd say, well, the economy's a little weak. We'd like to push it up, get the economy boosted. If the Federal Reserve notched it up a little bit, the Federal Reserve say, we're a little worried about inflation, the economy burning a little too fast, so we're going to notch it up and tell everyone this is what we're worried about. Like I said, or if they just left it alone, that was a signal in itself too. We like where the economy is. We think it's doing real well, and so we're going to leave the discount rate alone. So it was a message. Like I said, historically, banks didn't go to the discount window and actually borrow money at this rate. They went over into the interbank lending market. Interestingly enough, though, and I'll talk more about 2008 as this course goes along, but essentially 2008, did you see the movie Zombieland?
Yes.
Okay, that was it. We were very close to the zombie apocalypse. And I mean, most people don't know about Double Tap. They have no idea about cardio. We do, but most people didn't. And so we have to protect the weak people from the zombies of Wall Street. 2008 was as bad as it gets, and it was a spectacular. In one day, it just all came down. We came really close to the end of the financial world, seriously. So after it was over, you're talking about a global economy that was just staggering. Essentially, you got the whole financial world asked WTF. It's like waking up in the morning, and who is beside you? Justin Bieber. Who is beside you?
Jennifer Aniston.
No, Snooki. I mean, the whole global economy was just shaken. Just in one day it happened. And I'm going to show you part of why it happened. And by the end of this lecture, I'm going to turn you into a bunch of conspiracy theorists, maybe, if I can. But here's the thing, though. All of a sudden, you have the economy, all economies around the world, essentially in a catastrophic situation. It began with a liquidity crisis. In other words, there wasn't enough money. And then it turned into a credit crisis real fast because there wasn't enough money. The banks and other lending institutions just shut down. We're not going to lend anyone any money. You can kiss my ass. We are all going home and hide. And that is a catastrophe because it's essentially the lubricant that makes the world's economy move was at an end. No credit, no money flowing to businesses to make new investments, no money to keep their continuing projects going when they needed cash. So the Fed, one of the things that it did among many things was it just dropped this mother right down to the ground. 0%. Well, of course, if you can get free money, or somewhere around zero, if you can get free money, borrow it at 0%, well, that should give you an incentive to bring money in, and then, because you're getting a 0%, obviously, you'll lend it out, because you'll make a profit on it. So that was the one of the big efforts that the Federal Reserve made. It also, through market operations, brought this down hard, too. But by bringing this down to near 0%, the Federal Reserve was saying, banks, come and get it. You can give this money back to us later, but we want you to take money now and spread the wealth, lend like a bandit. Unfortunately, the banks took that money and they didn't lend it. They just gathered it up and put it into investments of their own, and the credit crisis continued. 2009, 2010, 2011, the banks were absorbing this free money, basically, this money that had 0% interest, rental rate of zero, and they were not lending it. So the credit crisis still held on for quite a while, which was one of the reasons that the economy just kept getting dragged down further and further into the recession that turned out to be the worst recession since the Great Depression. There was nothing, the credit crunch was just not letting up, even though banks were getting money at 0% from the discount window. Historically, banks didn't want to go to the discount window that much. Oh, they were lining up like a boss for that money, but they weren't lending it out. They were putting it into investments that weren't really helping the economy recover. So there you are. But anyway, enough of that. Bear with me one split second here. I want to see something. I'm going to launch this. Really? Is there some reason this sucks? Nope, it's not gonna. Oh, I have to unmute this. There. Okay, I'm getting that ready for a little later to show you something. But okay, let's get to the third tool of monetary policy, the big one. The third tool of monetary policy is called open market operations. And unfortunately, I'll have to invoke some economics, supply and demand, price goes up, price goes down, to carry this out. And once you get the understanding of it, it's not so bad. The Federal Reserve has a committee. It's called the Federal Open Market Committee, FOMC. On the FOMC are the seven governors. And then, this is voting. Everyone's there, but the voting members. The seven governors are always voting. And then there are five district bank presidents who are voting. They serve rotating terms, except for one of them. Four of them serve two-year terms, and then and they're staggered. So you might have the bank president of Atlanta on it right now. In 2 years, he'll go off, and maybe the president of the San Francisco bank will replace him. And that would happen with four of the five. Four serve two-year terms rotating. And then one is a permanent voter. Never changes. That is the president of the Empire Bank, the one in New York City, the one for the New York District, the Empire Bank. He always has a vote, even though he's just a district bank president. The reason is this. It's his bank that will carry out, execute the decisions of this Federal Open Market Committee, this FOMC. The FOMC works its decisions. They decide whether, well, they'll decide about going up with the discount rate or down with it or leaving it alone. But their big thing is whether they're going to pursue an expansionary monetary policy, pushing money into the economy, or a contractionary monetary policy, drain liquidity out of the economy. Because if there is a big inflation worry, they will want to claw liquidity out of the economy, get that money out before it turns into nothing but prices going up. If there is an economy that is suffering, they will probably want to push money into the economy to get the economy started again, get people money in their pockets, and they'll work harder, businesses will jump to life before they figure out that it's phony money, and then you got to stop that soon enough before it starts to be inflation. But there's contractionary and expansionary monetary policy. Let me take you through one side of it. Suppose that the FOMC votes and they decide that they are going to pursue an expansionary monetary policy. So the FOMC makes its decision. They argue, they look at their analyst reports, and they have people there that advise them. And then the expansionary monetary policy is decided on. Usually this is right done in secret, so arbitragers can't jump in front of them out in the open markets and play with what they know. Okay, now, the Empire Bank president, who is voted, takes the orders created by the FOMC. This is the New York president. And he communicates them back to the Empire Bank. Now, inside of the Empire Bank is this huge operation called the Domestic Trading Desk. DTD. When I say desk, I'm not talking about something you buy at Sears and put together a solder piece of furniture. I'm talking about a massive operation of just literally an uncountable number of traders, Federal Reserve traders who are in possession of the instruments to execute monetary policy. The New York president communicates the orders to the desk manager. The desk manager will then set it up, get everyone, all the traders on the same page, and then it's a go for the day. This happens day in, day out, every day of the year. It never quits. The engine that moves our economy back and forth, interest rates up, interest rates down, whether you have a job or not, a lot of that happens in these operations that almost no one on earth, except for students in business and economics, know about. It's a huge operation. Here's how it works. Okay. Madam, you're a desk trader. This is your desk, and you have the job of entering the open market with two assets. You have a pile of literally money, dollars. No, you can't leave and go shopping or anything like that. You also have an instrument as safe, it's a perfect substitute for dollars, called T-bills. The only thing about dollars is the banks can lend dollars. They can't lend T-bills. Now, I am over here, I am a bank. The capital that I have, there's some of it's really illiquid, there's some of it's a little more liquid. You know, real illiquid would be my asset, some of my heavy assets, then CDs, and then I've got all of this money. In the vault, I've got dollar bills on this side, and I've got treasury bills, my tier one capital. I have dollar bills, and I have T-bills. These represent my safest, most liquid assets. And I'm sitting here in my happy little bank. Now, remember that these dollars are actually down here in this pool called the federal funds pool. But they're mine. I can get them whenever I want. My T-bills are sitting in the vault or sitting in an electronic computer. And I'm sitting here, and you call me on the phone. Ring, ring. Hello? You want to make me have more money to lend. You want to expand the money supply, increase my liquidity. You want me to have more dollars. You have two things that you can use to do that, and I have two things. So you're going to try to make me have more dollars and fewer T-bills in my Tier 1 capital. That means that I will have expanded the pool of money. You and all these hundreds and hundreds of other traders are doing this. Okay, you've got this stuff. Ring, ring, hello. And you want to buy from me T-bills. Because if I give you a T-bill, you give me a dollar, there's more money in the economy. So go ahead. You got to remember the T-bills, they're close to $1,000. They're under $1,000 representing the yield on them. So, you want to buy from me some T-bills. Make me an offer. You want to buy, yeah, what do you want? I want to buy some of your T-bills. Oh, yeah? Well, I like my T-bills. Well, okay, give me an offer. I know, this is kind of, try, say $960. $960, are you kidding me? My T-bills, I like my T-bills. Bite me, click. So you call me back up again. Ring, ring. You again? What are you going to do this time? Give me an offer. 970. Now be bold about it. You're a trader. 970, sucker. And I say, bite me. And I hang up. So you call me back. 980. 980. You know what? I might just take you on that. The price was going up. She was bidding the price of a T-bill up. What does that do to the yield on a T-bill? As the price, she's pushing the price of T-bill up. What is that doing to the yield on that T-bill? Remember the relationship? Price goes up, yield goes. She's driving yields down. She and all the traders, by pushing demand, by demanding those T-bills, she's increasing the demand for T-bills, and whenever you increase the demand for anything, so here we've got T-bills. All these traders are out there. Here's the supply of T-bills. Here is the demand for T-bills, okay? And here's the price. It was the price of T-bills was right here, P1. She is now, and all those traders are going cuckoo bananas. They want T-bills. I want T-bills. That's going to shove the demand curve for T-bills outward, and that drives the price up. Price of T-bills going up, which means that the yield on T-bills is going down. Already, the domestic traders are affecting interest rates in the economy. Remember how I told you those T-bills were like the bottom rock-solid base of all interest rates? They're risk-free. She's causing that yield on those to slide downward. She and all those traders and all their demand, they're pushing prices of T-bills up like this, which is pushing the yields on T-bills down. The economy is already beginning to feel something because the yield on the base risk-free instrument in the economy is slipping under the pressure of these traders wanting T-bills. So, here we go. She takes a T-bill out of my inventory, it goes over here, and one of my dollars goes over to her in the federal funds pool. You and all these other traders with millions, tens, hundreds, billions of dollars are doing this. It's like a vast ocean happening, like a tide. So there you have the second effect is about to happen here. The second effect. Because you see, here's that federal funds pool, that big, vast money ocean of all the bank's money. The price of money in that pool, that's the lendable funds. That's the money that Banks have to lend to other banks, to businesses, to you. So its price would be the federal funds rate. Here's the demand for that money. And suddenly, all of these traders are buying T-bills from banks. And that means that as they are sending the electronic money into the federal funds pool on behalf of the banks, as they buy their T-bills, that supply of money in that pool is increasing. It's swelling up because the banks are selling their T-bills to the Fed, and then in exchange, the Fed is putting money into the federal funds pool in their accounts. So guess what happens to the federal funds rate? It starts to go down. Like I said, the Federal Reserve can't set the federal funds rate, but it can set a target, and then it can just keep pushing money in, just flooding the money into that pool by buying the bank's T-bills, and the federal funds rate goes down because of supply and demand dynamics. So over a period of time, the Fed, and it, remember, the, even at the vast scale at which this is happening, the federal funds pool is beyond words. It's so large, you know, trillions of dollars doesn't even describe it. So over a period of days and weeks and months, as the traders keep doing this, layering their attack on the banks, buying their T-bills, moving the money into the Fed, over a long period of time, what happens is that this federal funds pool expands. The supply of money the banks have to lend increases. The first rate would be the federal funds rate that they're lending to each other. And then that rate going down makes the rates on mortgages, on home mortgages, on car loans, and all of that go down as well. All of these things stimulate the economy. More money in people's pockets, lower yields on lower interest rates, so you tend to borrow more. Businesses are willing to take on investments that don't yield as much. The whole nine yards to wake the economy up, to start the economy on its road back to health. That's what the Federal Reserve has been doing for a long, long time. Bear with me here. Okay, that... Is there some reason why I can't get this to work? You know what? I am so damn sick. Is there some reason this sucks? Oh, that's all. There was electricity in that. Well, it will soften my stool. Okay. Really? I just turned off something that I shouldn't have. Now I'm sorry I did that. Okay, let's try it. I'll get that going here in a minute. Bear with me. Okay. Let me... Why? Okay. Oh, goody, it's got a label on it. It says computer. That must be the computer. Okay. Anyway, I'll let that kick on here. Now, the Fed could do it the other way, too. And you have to think about how the Fed would contract the money supply. If the Fed wanted to contract the money supply, you, a trader, would have to get me to give up my money and buy your treasury bills. Because remember, that desk has treasury bills and dollars. So in a contractionary environment, in a contractionary monetary environment, she with her dollars and her T-bills, and me over here as a bank with dollars and T-bills, she would want to try to induce me to give up dollars to the Fed in exchange for T-bills. In order to do that, she would have to drop the price of T-bills. She'd have to push the price down so that they look like a bargain. Oh, hell, that's great. $940 T-bill? Sure, I'll send you a $940. You send me that one of those nice T-bills. That would drain liquidity from the pool. That would drain liquidity from the pool. In a case like this, we would have interest rates going up because the price of T-bills was going down. We would also have the federal funds rate going up because money would be going out of the federal funds pool to the Fed, where the money would just be shredded, and in exchange, the banks would be building up T-bill reserves. There we go. I'm going to show you something in here in just a moment. This is how the Fed affects rates. But the truth of the matter is that the Fed, this affects short-term rates. This is how the Fed moves short-term rates. The long-term rates are harder because essentially what these traders are doing is moving dollars, which are a highly liquid shorter-term instrument. And so the longer-term rates are affected by this, but they are also affected by maturity premium, longer-term inflation worries, by default over longer periods of time, and all that kind of stuff. So the Fed's control over interest rates is really a short-term thing. And only for a while can the Fed just keep shoveling money into an economy to wake it up before that money starts to turn into inflation expectations. And that's a danger, because once we get an inflation expectation, even though the Fed would try to turn around the economy, the expectation would hold for a while. So you would have this disaster where the Fed was trying to contract the money supply, driving up interest rates, but the inflation expectation was still lingering, which would make interest rates even worse over a period of time. Now, if you'll bear with me one moment, I'm going to heave in here to get something up on the screen, if I can here. Show you something. Now, the links to these will be in the sidebar, too. Let me do it this way. I'll quit it. Oh, goody, we've got a Google search bar. Menu bar, good. Edit, find, there. Doom. Okay. Now, I had brought up the idea of different types of money. M1, M2, M3. Representing different layers of liquidity. The tightest definition of money is M0. No one talks about M0, although it's kind of interesting to see what it's been doing over the past 4 years or so. M0 is nothing but just cash and currency. But like I said, I don't think you'll even run into an economics course where they'll talk about M0, although it is out there. And then there is M1, which includes M0 and also demand deposits, those checking accounts at real banks and traveler's checks. So M1 includes M0 plus some other stuff that's highly liquid, checking accounts and things like that. And then a larger definition of money would be M2. Now, really, when I talk about open market operations, I'm talking about M0, M1. I'm talking about M1, really. The Fed moving M1 around. M2 includes M1, but it also includes smaller time deposits, CDs, things that are not as easy to liquidate, but still not that bad to liquidate. And then you have this large definition of money that includes M2, but it also includes massive time deposits. We're talking about CDs, $100 million, things like that. We're talking about euro dollars. Euro dollars are money, U.S. money that is in the banks, central banks of other countries. Like when you buy a toaster from China, you get a toaster, they get American dollars. Now the merchants never get the dollars. The Central Bank of China gives the merchant the equivalent in the Chinese currency, and then it holds the American dollars as a foreign reserve. Same thing if we buy oil from Canada, or we buy a car from Japan. We get the item, they get the money, and then the dollars themselves are held in their central bank. That is what is called a euro dollar. And this M3 includes huge time deposits and euro dollars. They are highly illiquid. They are used for massive investments. Like the Chinese, for example, their American dollars that they hold that they get from us buying their stuff, they use those to lend to our government to keep for the budget deficits. They also are used for bank loans. They're used for your loans. That money over there can't be used anywhere else in the world. It's American dollars, so the Chinese bring that money back in long-term investment. So basically, you have what's called a current account, where we get a toaster, they get American dollars. And then there's the long-term backswing of that same money in what's called the capital account, where the dollars come back here as investment in the United States by the foreign country. And in exchange, we give them promises for future cash flows, interest, and payments later on. So you have the current account going this way, and then the capital account goes this way. So that money that's in this international flow is in this M3. Now let's talk about what that means. The Federal Reserve historically reported all of these different money supplies. So let me show you what that looks like here. Oh, there's my stool. And I'll pull this up. This is from an article. I wrote a series of articles back in the early part of the 21st century leading up to the crisis. Warning, there's a really bad thing going to happen. I tried to explain and it kind of to an educated audience, maybe not economics people, but educated. It's going to get bad. Here's what's going on. I was ignored and things like that. But here's what we're talking about. Okay, this was a chart this was a Federal Reserve chart. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about the Federal Reserve chart. There really was no recession after the early 1990s. But in 2002, after President Bush was elected, there were claims that we were having such a bad recession that we had to give the largest, longest tax cuts in history. It was a lie. The Federal Reserve's chairman at the time jumped in on the lie. A lot of people in Congress knew it was a lie. There wasn't any recession up until 2008, between 1992 and 2008. Now, if you were to look at a chart like this, you'll never see this chart on the Federal Reserve site again. I got this from part of it, most of it from the Federal Reserve. I had to add some stuff. But if you look at that chart now at the Federal Reserve, you would see a gray band showing that there was a recession here. They've changed their story since the time that I created this chart, back when I was trying to warn that things were going to get bad. There really wasn't a recession, but now the Federal Reserve says there was. Let's go on here. Okay, let's talk about monetary policy. We've got the three different money supplies. Green is M1, blue is M2, and red is M3. Now, the first thing that was going on was that the chairman, Alan Greenspan, by the mid-1990s, late 1990s, he was getting very angry at the Clinton administration. And it was pretty obvious because the federal budget deficits were disappearing and we started running federal surpluses. That meant that there were no longer any treasury bills being issued by the government. They didn't need to borrow money. But if there are no treasury bills, the open market operation is shut down. The Fed has no power in OMOs. And so you saw Alan Greenspan starting in the mid-1990s saying that this economy that just kept growing and growing can't be anything more than an inflation about to happen. So he started clamping the money supply down, crushing M1, crushing it. And the economy still kept going on, but it stopped and it went into a pause. Not a recession, but that pause was enough for the claim to be made that there was a recession and the tax cuts that are still haunting us to this day. And the surpluses just vanished within a couple of years and the history was made. Federal budget deficits as far as the eye could see. But we had it. We had the surpluses. We were starting to pay down the national debt. We were talking about an unbelievable golden era could have happened, but it didn't. That's not the point of this story. The money supply began to expand, but then notice what happened to the growth rate. These are growth rates of the money supply. Look at what happened to M1 starting right after about Ben Bernanke took over from Alan Greenspan. Do you see what happened to the money, the growth rate of M1, the money that you and I, that small businesses, even big businesses, use for all their day-to-day transactions. The real economy was growing at a rate from about 2.5% to 3.5%, but the money to keep that economy flowing wasn't there. The growth rate of the money supply of M1 was dying. It was at basically, that's a little under zero, the mean growth rate of the money supply. Essentially, from about 2005, it was about 2005, a little bit before that, the Federal Reserve carried out a contractionary monetary policy, and the money supply that we use for everyday actions was going away. That was the liquidity crisis. It finally came to a head. But notice that the growth rate of M2 was around 5%, and it was slowly growing. So remember that M1 wasn't growing, and M1 is an M2. So you had the component of M2 that is not liquid money must have been growing at a very hard rate. In order for M2 to grow at 5%, but M1, which is in it, to grow at zero, that extra thing that's M2 but not M1 must have been growing really fast. But then, look at what's happening to M3. The Federal Reserve declared in the spring of 2006 that it would no longer publish M3. It said, oh, no one uses that, no one needs it. Well, you can see why they were stopped publishing it. M3 was growing at a staggering rate. This highly illiquid pool of money that couldn't be used for anything except asset value was just skyrocketing to the point whereby into 2008, moving towards the liquidity crisis, it was up above 15%. And that kind of one of the theories, and I won't say one way or the other whether that's the one that's correct or not, is that the Federal Reserve under Bernanke was afraid to go to Congress and say, we're in trouble, this is growing, I can't stop it because these are euro dollars, the Fed has no control over that money in those other banks, in the central banks, it's growing like a boss, I can't stop it, so the only thing I can do is crush the money that I can control. That's the only thing we can, that's one explanation. But one way or the other, M3 was growing at a staggering rate. It's money that you can't use for anything. So of course you had these banks that had these massive illiquid deposits start throwing that money into things that were side bets. It's like having a giant house. You got all that value, but you can't buy a meal, so you use that house for side bets, for money that you can use to pay your bills. That was probably what was at the heart of the whole giant catastrophe that became the credit derivative swaps market. They were writing these things like they were water, and they were making a few dollars off each one that they wrote, and they write them on, they'd stack them on top of each other, a credit derivative swap on a credit mortgage obligation. And by the time it was over, these things were like a toxic waste of with a notional value approaching $100 trillion. Just so that there could be a little bit of real money to pay the bills. No evil involved. The whole talk about, well, there were these greedy sons of bitches on Wall Street. Yeah, they're greedy sons of bitches, but that wasn't what was at the heart of it. The heart of it was this rapidly growing M3 and an M1 that was dead in the water. And sure enough, the last article I wrote, I think it was in June of 2008, I wrote an article called The Gospel According to Doom. And I was linking up with some other economists who were writing, we were fringe marginals, financial economists. We were saying, this is going to end badly and very soon. Well, it did. In September, on the morning, I think it was September 15th, the jockeys at the Fed were looking at flows of money around the world, looking at the numbers, looking at the charts, and they saw something interesting, something that was a little more than interesting. They saw extraordinary amounts of money being withdrawn from the money markets in the United States. The banks on the East Coast were suffering not just bleeding, they were hemorrhaging buckets of money market funds being withdrawn. Well, of course, if money is being withdrawn, the first thing you do is, okay, where is it going? Well, this must be some kind of freak out. Is everyone getting scared and going and buying gold? We should see gold prices going like that. It was just disappearing. It was just being withdrawn. 100 billion, 200. 300. It would be very soon when there would not be any money left to satisfy these money market obligations. I guess it was 10 o'clock or something like that. They saw it about noon. The Federal Reserve saw $550 billion of money market withdrawals, and they just said, okay, everyone stop. We're on the authority of the Fed. There will be no more withdrawals from money markets. It's over. Whoever the hell it is who's taking it out, you're done for the day. You're done for good. And that was, of course, when the crisis began, because already that much money had gone out. We didn't see where it went. Yeah, a few days later, we started seeing spikes in commodity metal prices, but still to this day, and I don't think anyone can give me a decent answer that I'll buy, where it was going there for about 48 hours. But it was within 24 hours, the chairman of the Fed, the secretary of the Treasury had gone to Congress and said, you need to close the doors, put the Congress, the House of Representatives, into martial law so that no one can leave, because we have got a problem and you guys have got to solve it here. And matter of fact, there was a kind of crazy representative at the time. One of his most lucid moments was when he said, Madam Chairman, to Nancy Pelosi, Madam Chairman, are we under martial law? She didn't answer him. And he said, yeah, we're under martial law. I can't leave. And so the solution was made, and they just started flooding money into the economy as fast as they could. They cleaned up the banks. They started satisfying liquidity obligations. And we were on the road to the worst recession since the Great Depression, and slowly clawing our way out of it. We didn't have money in the Treasury to do it, so we just had to print money, and we're still printing it to this day to keep the economy from flopping back over. That was the story of what happened. Kind of a boring story, but it's also kind of an interesting story. But I want to show you something just to turn you guys into conspiracy theorists. Is that okay? Make you really creeped out. You know, I show you these charts and I think, oh, this is always fun to show. And it's someone inevitably, well, why did you not talk about, what was that hell with that spike right there and that giant drop spike right there? Does anyone know what that spike was right there? See, when the buildings were attacked by the whack jobs from Saudi Arabia and Jordan, they crashed into a couple of buildings. The first thing that the Federal Reserve would logically think is, oh my God, people are going to freak. They're going to run their banks because they're going to think the nation is under attack. Truth be told, you had 12 idiots hit buildings. There was no danger to the country, but you know, people being normal, you know, my God, I better run to the bank and get my money. Of course, you know that the banks don't have everyone's money, so there would be runs and the banking system could collapse from something like that. So what the Fed did was, it, like an incredible operation, all over the country, every Fed just cranked money into giant trucks and got it to every bank in the country to make sure that no bank would have less than enough money to satisfy anyone who freaks out and comes in. So in other words, if everyone in the country ran to their bank to get their money out and put it under the mattress, the Federal Reserve had made enough money, put enough money into the banks, literally driving trucks, huge convoys of trucks, to make sure that all the banks had the liquidity they needed. And then this down spike was when the Fed said, all right, everyone's cool. Turned out there wasn't really any runs, but they left the money there for a while, and then when everything looked like it was cool, the Fed pulled the money back out of the banks and took it back home and shredded it. Okay, that's the story of the spikes. That's all I have for you. Go home.